Hey, everybody. I want to welcome you to the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. This is your host, Mance Rader. This is episode 119. It's going up on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, eVooks, YouTube, on my website, freemanbeyondthewall.com. In the episode section, there's a link to my podcast host, and it'll be on libertarianinstitute.org/Mance. I want to remind you about my books, Freedom Through Memedom and The Kids Are Not All Right. They're available on Amazon. They are also available at freemanbeyondthewall.com/store. And on the website, you can only buy it for cryptocurrency. So I wrote the book, The Kids Are Not All Right, about the culture of college campuses, what I've seen as a problem brewing for a while now, but definitely come to the forefront of the last few years. So I decided to invite Ian Miles Chung on. Ian's a journalist. He covers media, politics, and culture for Daily Caller. I wanted to talk to him about social justice warriors, and Ian has a great take on them, as he used to be a social justice warrior. As a matter of fact, when the famous Gamergate was going on, he was on the other side of it. He was on the social justice side. And he's come over to the free speech side. He's come over to what I like to call the side of sanity. So he and I had a discussion, and we talked about where this came from, how we got here, where we think it's going, and how we can solve this problem. So without any further delay, here's a conversation I had with Ian Miles Chung. All right, everybody, I'm here with Ian Miles Chung. How you doing today, Ian?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Doing good. Ian is literally on the opposite side of the world from me. You're literally 12 hours. Are you ahead of me or behind me?
12 hours, I guess, behind you? I mean, it's already, or no, ahead of you, because it's what? It's the next day, right?
You're in Malaysia.
That's correct, yeah.
But you're on East Coast time, so, you live U.S. East Coast time. Cool.
Pretty much.
I wanted to have Ian on today because I wrote a book called The Kids Are Not All Right, where I try to give a little background, some of the history that I have, some of the knowledge I have of thought speech, thought police, controlling speech, where it came out of Marxism, some of the history of it, and especially this social justice warrior phenomenon that we've seen in really coming to the forefront in the last decade. And Ian has a very interesting point of view on it, because you would consider yourself to be anti-SJW now.
But I used to be an SJW, yeah.
You were an SJW. You weren't even an SJW when Gamergate was going on.
That's correct, yeah. I was an SJW back when it happened. I was pretty close to all the people on anti-Gamergate, you know, the games journalist. I was a games journalist, so I was part of that crew.
Okay, so, all right. Where do you, from what you know, how far back do you go? And if you're going to look at the history of what's going on right now, How far back do you want to go to start talking about where all this came from, where the modern origin of it is?
The modern origin of social justice. Well, I would go back to academia, right, in like the 70s. That's where I would point to, where, you know, postmodernism basically started to infect universities and colleges and institutions of higher learning through professors who were, I don't know if they were indoctrinated, but they were definitely indoctrinating people to Marxist ideas. That's where I would go to.
Now, a lot of people have heard the term postmodernism. People talk about Foucault. Thaddeus Russell is trying to redefine what postmodernism is. What is postmodernism to you?
Postmodernism to me is basically critical theory. It's the idea that everything should be questioned. And, I mean, there's no doubt that everything should be questioned, but they are doing it to a point where they say that objectivity itself should be questioned, and that truth itself is a construct. the idea that there is a universal truth, the ability to define what is right and what is wrong. All these things need to be questioned because they are tools of the cis patriarchal, heterosexual, patriarchy, whatever thingy. I lose track of all the words they add to the chain.
So, you talked about postmodernism in the 70s. I'll go back and talk a little bit about the 60s. In the 60s, on campuses, we saw people carrying free speech signs, people protesting the war. When do you see the change made where now free speech is, well, maybe some speech is really dangerous to, let's say, what they would say, marginalized people?
Mm-hmm. I would say they're using it as a tool. I mean, originally the establishment was pretty much right wing, not necessarily, you know, ultra conservative or anything like that, but definitely right wing. And these things, you know, it was easy for them to argue for free speech when they were the ones, I guess, being not necessarily oppressed, but shut down, right? People were refusing to listen to them, so they would claim that they were being silenced and so forth. And there were, of course, actual cases where people were silenced, like during the Vietnam War, protesters were shot at and so on. But they have kept up that victim mentality, right? Originally, I'm sure they were victims. Some people are definitely oppressed, but they keep that mentality up. And even when they do become the establishment, when the Democrats, for instance, went a lot into the left wing, they kept up this idea that they were still members of the marginalized class. And they certainly are not, because the media, as we can see it today, is pretty much all left-wing, not all left-wing, but, you know, mostly left-wing, with the exception of companies like Fox News or Breitbart. But everyone else is leaning towards the left, some very far left, like Media Matters. And so they've kept up this idea, they've pushed this idea, they've fed it to people that they're the underdog and that they're marginalized people. So obviously people are going to say, hey, aren't you guys the ones in power? Now you're the ones, you know, shutting down free speech. What's up with that? They twist it around. They say that, well, we needed free speech to speak truth to power. That's what they always say. Black Lives Matter and so forth. But nowadays it's more about shutting down other people's speech more so than it is to speaking their own truth, because they claim that other people being able to speak their minds is somehow oppressing them.
Do you think that the left, and I'm talking about the far left, own the mainstream media. Yeah, academia, government.
Mm-hmm.
Do they know this and they're just going to do this anyway? You know, they know they're not marginalized. They know that pretty much, you know, they always talk about, you know, oh, Trump is literally Hitler.
Okay. Yeah.
Hitler had academia and the press on his side.
Mm-hmm.
That's how he was able to take power. They have academia, they have the press, they have most of the people in the government.
Do they
realize this and they're just playing this game to gain more power, or are they delusional and did not realize that they basically hold all the cards?
I think many of them are just delusional. It depends on who you're talking about, right? Like the media, obviously someone like Jim Acosta, he's not a dumb guy, right? He might ask dumb questions, but he's not a dumb guy. He knows what he's doing. He knows how to play this game. A lot of the Never Trump people on Twitter, for example, many of them know that they're not marginalized. Many of them are millionaires. People like Joss Whedon, Hollywood, they know they have a lot of power. They have a lot of sway, but they're not happy with the amount of power that they have. They want to have total power, supreme power, right? Total control. On the other hand, there's these people on Tumblr. There's the, you know, the younger people, the people who will wear Che Guevara shirts. They actually believe that they're not the ones in power and that they are speaking dangerous truths. They're afraid of being marginalized. They actually believe the propaganda that's being fed to them. I call these people the useful idiots. I think Yuri Bezmenov, former KGB agent, talked about these types of people where they would, you know, be used by those in power who teach them that they're marginalized, who tell them that they're being oppressed, and basically use them as their foot soldiers.
Hmm. Okay. Let's go to, I think, do you think Gamergate is what brought this, what brought a lot of this into the forefront on social media and in the mainstream media? Not so much the mainstream media. Did it ever really hit the mainstream media?
It hit the mainstream media, yeah. It was in the New York Times. They were interviewing people like Anita Sarkeesian, Brianna Wu, who, by the way, is not actually a victim, was not actually attacked, went out of her way to attack people, and then, you know, pretty much everyone who saw it knew what she was doing. They were like, okay, this person's just seeking attention. We're not going to pay her any attention. But the media bit into it because to them it was just, you know, another way to sell newspapers, another way to create a narrative. But so, yeah, it did approach the mainstream. I think a lot of people got woken up by that.
Well, let's do this before we go on. What was Gamergate?
What was Gamergate? It's a movement for ethics in games journalism. That's essentially what it was. And a lot of people tell you different stories about it, but the way it started was with censorship. And it started rather innocuously, I want to say. A woman named Zoe Quinn, her ex-boyfriend published a blog post called The Zoe Post, and it detailed how she had cheated on him, emotionally manipulated him, and so on. And it went pretty much viral because she was not necessarily, you know, well-known as a game developer, but she was well-known as a personality in video games, right? Everyone knew who she was because she had a lot of friends. Articles that talk about her normally, you know, like she made a game called Depression Quest. It's not really a game. It's more like a interactive adventure, but I digress. So people were talking about it. They were talking about this, you know, what about this blog post. And in response, all the social media websites, with the exception of Twitter and Facebook at the time, censored them from talking about it. Gaming websites were banning people for talking about it. They were calling them misogynists. And that became sort of the narrative where games journalists, refusing to mention Zoe Quinn by name, decided to talk about misogyny in the video game industry. Because there is this ongoing narrative that gamers hate women. And, you know, there's misogynists anywhere. They will cherry pick, you know, if you wanted to cast aspersions towards any group, you could always cherry pick certain examples. You know, maybe 1 out of 100 of them would be a bad post or bad tweet, and then you can craft pretty much anything you want. That's what the media does with any story. I mean, even on the right wing, we do it too. Although it's easier for us to actually find crazy SJWs these days. But they made this, you know, a whole series of posts called "Gamers Are Over, Gamers Are Dead." It became like a controversy where gamers felt like they were being attacked. They would go to these websites to read about video game news, and they would, you know, read this article, and it was calling them basically man children. And many of them were women. Many of them are grown men who just, you know, play video games because it's a great way to blow off steam. They got upset, and they couldn't talk about how upset they were because they were being censored everywhere. And so hashtag Gamergate started as a response to that, and now the media just ran with it, refusing to mention her by name again, just continuing to attack video gamers. And that was, you know, that was a thing that happened. And so Adam Baldwin, the actor, he coined the term Gamergate. He hashtagged it Gamergate. He watched a couple of videos on this subject and he coined it, and that's how it caught on. Everyone was less interested in the Zoe post, right? They were not interested in Zoe Quinn. They were interested in the fact that they were being censored and the fact that they were being demonized by the very press that was supposed to be defending them. Because, you know, video games have always been under attack in the 80s, in the 90s, in the early 2000s. You know, there's this guy, a conservative named Jack Thompson. He used to attack video gamers for being sociopaths. He would link them to school shooters. And game journalists will always defend video games, and they did it very well. But now it seems that they were refusing to do so because they had all become feminists. So that's what happened. That's what Gamergate is. And it, you know, it continues to this day, not because of the Gamergate supporters, but because the journalists, anytime something happens, you know, anytime Elon Musk calls out the press, says that you guys are lying about me, or maybe Palmer Luckey, you know, the creator of the Oculus Rift, says you're lying about me, they'll say, oh, it's Gamergate 2.0, or it's Gamergate all over again. They're using Gamergate tactics to silence female journalists. It's all part of the narrative, and I think people are really sick of it because they keep using feminism or their, you know, their femininity or something as a defense, even though most of the journalists being criticized are probably men.
So, Sarkeesian and Wu, these are the female names that are most associated. You said that Wu was never attacked. She was never a victim, and that implied that Sarkeesian was. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. Okay, so with Wu, she was a unknown game developer from Boston, made an independent game that no one bought called Revolution 60. No one cared about it, but she used Gamergate as a vehicle to celebrity because she made a bunch of memes, real bad memes, like autism memes. And used that to mock Gamergate supporters. And she went on to 8chan, which is like 4chan at the time, and she linked to her own post saying that, look at this feminist, let's go harass her. And people were not buying it. They were like, well, you posted this yourself. You know, why would we care about this? And then it didn't matter, though, because she got contacted by Huffington Post Live, which did an interview with her, and that snowballed into more interviews with the mainstream press. And that's how she became known as, you know, Gamergate's number one victim, even though no one had actually attacked her. People just make fun of her because she says stupid stuff. Like, she claims that Elon Musk is a danger to society because he's going to build a base on the moon, that he's going to use moon rocks, to gather moon rocks to bombard Earth with. Actual thing. And now she's running for Congress.
And what about Sarkeesian? Because I think, didn't Sarkeesian end up testifying before Congress
about that? United Nations. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah,
Zoe Quinn.
That's right. Okay, yeah. So
with Anita Sarkeesian, her thing started long before Gamergate. Gamergate happened in 2014, August 2014. With Sarkeesian, it was in around 2012 when she announced that she wanted to make a series of web videos on YouTube about tropes versus women in video games. The idea, you know, she's like a media critic, so she takes these, you know, tropes. If you don't know what those are, they're like, you know, cliches, and dissects them from like a feminist viewpoint. And her idea was that video games were misogynist, so or that they had issues that were problematic, you know, quote unquote. And she wanted to find out how video games are problematic, and so she kickstarted a crowdfund that got you know, tens of thousands of dollars to make this video series. And so people gave her a bunch of money, and while she was crowdfunding, people got upset, obviously. They were like, well, video games are not, you know, they're not misogynist. Maybe some of them are, like a handful of them are, but they're not what you are portraying them as. And, you know, we have doubts about this. And obviously, some gamers were not able to restrain themselves, and they started calling her, you know, all sorts of misogynistic slurs. And she used those attacks against her as PR for herself, basically. And, you know, I appreciate her hustle. I know what she's doing. I appreciate her hustle. But it was, you know, it was what it was. People did attack her, so I will say that, you know, she was victimized in a sense. And some people even called in, like, bomb threats on her. And here's the thing. I'm not even sure that it was gamers who called in the bomb threats when she was going to speak at, you know, universities. It was, in my opinion, it was probably someone either like a troll or someone on her site realizing that this would actually be good PR for her. And, you know, it's a thing that feminists often do. So she was actually victimized, and the media ran with it because they saw, hey, here's a victim. We need to support her. Helps our narrative as well because, you know, video game journalists, if I have to tell you something about them, it's that they're elitists. They feel like they're smarter than the people they write for, right? They look down on other gamers. They think that they are like the de facto source for gaming information. And so when YouTube took over, you know, when YouTubers came up, they basically lost their relevance. But at the time, you know, they were, it was very easy for them to push a narrative, and obviously these people all run in the same circles, so the idea that gamers are being misogynistic was of course picked up by the mainstream press, and, you know, a couple of years afterwards, Gamergate was implicated in the whole thing. People were rewriting history, trying to make it seem like Gamergate was a movement for harassing women in video games, because that was the easy thing to do. They would say, hey, look at this Gamergate supporter. Look at him oppose Anita Sarkeesian. And I think the reason why Gamergate was so anti-SJW, now many of them are even liberals, but the reason why they oppose social justice was because social justice warriors were using feminism again as a way to bully their way into video games, to kick everybody else out, and you know, gamers felt like they were being attacked, and they were certainly.
So right around this time, it's when I started to notice stories coming off of college campuses. Stories about professors getting in the faces of other faculty about, you know, things that they were teaching that they thought were hate speech, which could have been, you know, sociology, could have been the difference between the sexes, things like that. What was the first thing that you noticed, like the first real blow up coming off a college campus that you noticed that you could tie to everything that was going on with in the wake of Gamergate?
I would say it was the University of Missouri protests. If you recall, you know, they're a J school, a journalism school, and it was about I think it was about Black Lives Matter. That's where I can first tied into Gamergate. I think slightly a few months before that, there were there was a cultural appropriation protest at Yale, where I think someone dressed up in like a Mexican costume and people got upset. So that was the thing. They got like two professors fired because the professors were like, hey, this is Halloween. Take it easy. You know, don't freak out about cultural appropriation. It's just one night. It's not a big deal. People are just having fun. You guys are way too serious about this. And they got fired because, not fired, but I think they had to quit their jobs because they were essentially pushed out of the campus by the students themselves who didn't like the fact that they were not being politically correct. And, you know, afterwards it escalated. There was, you know, University of Missouri where the teacher was calling for muscle to push out journalists who were hostile to her. There was, of course, the Evergreen. Evergreen was, I think, the really big one. That's when everyone started taking notice of this, because at first it seemed sporadic, but then it just escalated to pretty much every university. University of Wisconsin had its own issues, and now, as we know, the state of Wisconsin has created a bunch of laws and basically stripped the university of all these useless classes, like sociology classes or whatever, stuff that people are not going to get jobs with.
Where do you see this going? How does this end? Is it gaining momentum? Is it just going along at an even pace? Is it dying?
I would say it's actually gaining momentum. It's going to get worse before it gets better. And I know that sounds very pessimistic, but that was my view even in 2015, 2016, 2017. It's only going to get worse. People are going to virtue signal even louder, because the way that Twitter algorithms work is that they signal boost you if you're really woke. And people want to be part of that algorithm. You notice nowadays that people are getting offended over pretty much anything, right? It's gotten to a point where, you know, it's not just like, back in the day, someone would have to be, you know, like maybe really racist to get called out, and that would go viral, get maybe 10,000 retweets. Now you can get offended at a movie, about racism, you know, like, I think HBO is making a series in which the Confederacy won the Civil War, and people got so offended by that to a point where, you know, it's getting hundreds of thousands of retweets of people calling for that show to be canceled. We're seeing a picture in Vanity Fair of, I think, some celebrity, maybe it's a Cardi B or something, I don't know. She's getting her hair done by another, by a black hairstylist. And people are offended by that. there's two black women, and they're offended by it, and their claim is that, well, imagine if the celebrity were a white woman, this would look really bad. And it's like, they don't even have to, the white people don't even have to be in the picture for them to be offended. You can just imagine them there. It's ridiculous. And when I looked at that tweet, I was like, okay, this is crazy. But it's got 5,000 retweets.
Yeah.
And it's just every day. So people are just finding more and more ways to be offended by things. I think the most recent blow up that everyone remembers, it went international, was the Chinese dress, the prom dress. Girl wears a nice prom dress. Looks like, you know, it's like one of those Chinese traditional dresses. Some guy gets offended and it gets 100,000 retweets. She gets bullied, but thankfully she's got fortitude and she stands her ground. And that gets even more retweets. And, you know, places as far as Malaysia, yeah, or China are talking about this. We're like, what is cultural appropriation? This is not really a thing. We like it when other people wear a traditional dresses. It's not a big deal. Americans are crazy. That's the response.
Yeah, the guy who responded to that said, my culture is not your goddamn prom dress. So, Of course, what did people do? They went back in his tweets and found some really racist shit, some actual racist shit.
Actual racist him stuff. Using the black people.
Yeah. You know, and it's like, dude, you know, what the fuck? I mean, we spend way too much time on Twitter. And
you do.
Here's the thing. If you spend as much time on Twitter as we do, you think you have the idea that either the culture, one part of the culture is way over to the right, or the other part of the culture is way over to the left, when it's just really the loudest people. I mean, think about it. It's the Pareto principle. 80% of the people who are on Twitter probably don't even tweet. You know, they're just reading tweets, you know, and 20%. Yeah. And really, if you take that 20% and you took 20% of that and you tore it down and tore it down, really it's 1% making, you know, 1% making the kind of, spending the kind of time on Twitter that you and I do.
There's like a reverb effect, right? Where, because journalists in general are spending as much time on Twitter as we do, they have a skewed perception of reality. So when they see everyone in their timeline, who are, by the way, you know, the 20%, getting mad about something that no one cares about, they assume that everybody's mad about it. Whereas the people watching their news, they're like, well, this seems crazy. I don't care about this. You know, if you go to Facebook and you're not part of these groups and you're just, you know, part of your regular friend circle, there'll be maybe that one guy who's constantly tweeting out Hillary memes, or, you know, virtue signaling against Donald Trump. But most people are just gonna just roll their eyes at all this. They think it's crazy. I mean, I interact with a lot of people who don't spend as much time on Twitter as I do, and they think it's really insane how these people are getting, because the craziest people are the ones getting signal boosted. They're getting amplified by the media. The media is not helping matters at all. It's actually making things worse. It's making it seem more divided than it actually is. I don't think most people care about having these differences. I mean, a liberal can be friends with conservatives. No big deal.
Yeah, I think it's pretty obvious that Twitter plays with certain accounts, because, you know, someone that has as many followers as I do, I don't get as many impressions as I probably should. Yeah. Every once in a while I'll go and I'll check the impressions and I'll be like, yeah, there's something going on here. And then somebody who doesn't have a blue check mark and somebody who has maybe 3,000 followers tweets something out, and within like an hour they have like 15,000 retweets. And you're like, how the hell did this, wait a minute, how did this happen?
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. It's because of what Twitter's pushing to the front, right? It's what people see. They see it, they're like, oh, this is retweeted by celebrity so-and-so, I'm going to press retweet. And that's how it just keeps blowing up. Because certain accounts, I would assume, have that weight to them. They carry that weightiness. And I noticed recently, because, you know, for a while I was tweeting, I would say, on the right? And my tweets would not get as much engagement as they should. I mean, I have 85,000 followers, and they were getting like a maximum of maybe 200 retweets, which is pretty low for someone with 85,000 followers. So obviously people weren't seeing my tweets. Like, I don't think you ever see Adam Baldwin's tweets, for example. And he knows he's been, you know, not necessarily shadow banned, but certainly stifled, right? And I was noticing the same thing. But then I started tweeting more, you know, I'm like a pro-LGBT guy. And so I've been tweeting pro-LGBT stuff, and it suddenly my tweets are now shot up to like 2,000 retweets. I mean, what's going on there? It's obvious because I think it's because someone on like on the left, you know, someone whose account is, I guess, not being stifled, retweeted me that my account is now in association with it. So people who would normally not even see my tweets are now actually seeing them.
Yeah, it's funny because if you retweet me, you don't, it doesn't get as many retweets as like if you put out something pro LGBT and you know, I'm I'm a hardcore libertarian anarchist. I don't care what anybody fucking does, you know, LGBT mm-hmm. doesn't mean anything to me because I don't care about it. I just care about how you treat other people. You know? I mean, that means nothing to me. If I saw somebody who was pro-LGBT or someone who identified as LGBT on Twitter getting attacked, I would step in and defend that person as long as they weren't being an asshole. Recently I've looked at some of the accounts that are attacking me and it's like, do you have any idea that I had somebody who was attacking me because I was complaining about Obama's war stance about bombing 7 countries. And immediately mm-hmm. they're like, well, you're not saying anything about Trump doing that. And I'm like, have you gone back in my timeline 5 minutes?
Yeah.
It's like, come on. You know, people can...
They have these preconceptions, right, about you, about me, about anyone. People actually expect me to be homophobic, and that's kind of sad. I will post something that's pro-LGBT, you know, friendly to LGBT, and I will get attacked because they're expecting me to say something awful instead.
How dare you be on our side?
Yeah, and what's worse is, you know, so obviously I have an impact on what my followers think because they follow me for my thoughts. And, you know, I feel like I'm making a positive change by, you know, not being a fucking asshole all the time. And you know, that's better than, you know, calling people who disagree with you. Like, let's just say someone I know is homophobic. I'm not going to call them an asshole for it. I might, you know, not even try to teach them, but maybe show them why it's not, you know, not great to be homophobic, right? Because they don't know any gay people, maybe. You know, maybe their only experience with a gay person is some jerk on Twitter who treated them badly. So, you know, they came away with that. But I'm obviously making a better impact than, you know, an SJW is going on and screaming homophobe at everybody. So these SJWs, they will attack me, not because of what I said, but because my followers disagree with me. Oh, like a handful of them opposed what I just said. So therefore, I'm a bad person. Come on. I have more of an impact to these people who disagree with me than they ever will.
I was watching somebody yell at Michael Malice because... And they said, Michael, do you realize that you have Nazis that follow you? He's like, yes, what the fuck do you want me to do?
Yeah.
He's like, if they comment anything really vile, you know, he has a habit of muting them or even outright blocking them. But it's like, I mean, I have people that say vile shit all the time and I usually mute them or block them. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. I'm real open about, you know, if you come in there and you're pro war, if you're like a neo, you know, have that classic neocon thinking, I won't block you. I will go at you. I'll go back and forth with you. But
yeah.
I mean, if you start getting hateful, you know, I mean, if you start targeting, you know, mm-hmm. targeting groups for no reason whatsoever, or just, you know, or just the whole thing about how if you're anti-war, you have to be on the left, or, you know, it's like, come on, guys.
Yeah.
You know, it's destroying, you know, basically what I try to do is I try to destroy as many fallacies as possible. And, yeah. You know, there's so many fallacies about there about everything, about economics, about foreign policy, about culture. Mm-hmm. So let me ask you about this. You know, we were talking about SJWs, and we went off on a rant, which is really easy to do if you talk about social media. What do you I put in my book, the last chapter of my book is how I think we deal with this, how we fight this war. How do we win this, man?
By we, I assume you're referring to the side of moderation, the side that's not crazy, right?
Because
there's more than two sides,
People who don't have to be an extremist. People who are for free speech, people who are for free thought, you know? People who are like, you know, people like me who are like, you know, I think Richard Spencer is, a, you know, he's awful. He gets 10 people who show up, he gets 10 people to show up to, you know, to hear him now. And, you know, and, but I don't want, if somebody's hateful or preaching something really violent or something really vile, I want to hear it. I don't want those people going into the shadows, because when they go into the shadows, that's when shit gets really fucked up, because they start, they start planning stuff. And that's when you see, start seeing, you know, federal buildings blowing up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so how is people who believe in free speech and people who believe, you know, who are moderate, who want to take the freedom road, how do we fight these people on the left who are just seem to have lost their minds?
You know, we have to live by our principles. I've always believed that. I don't think that it's okay necessarily to, you know, play by the by their rule book, because their rule book says to censor people you disagree with, and that goes against everything we stand for. So I would say that we should continue to embody the beliefs that we, you know, espouse, and, you know, bring it all out into the open and allow people to have these conversations, because the only way to shut down a bad idea, or not, you know, shut down is like the bad word, to basically debunk a bad idea is to, well, to debunk it publicly. You can't debunk a bad idea if you're not allowed to talk about it. And that's the issue with the left, is that they prevent people from having these conversations. They prevent people from talking about issues that they find disagreeable, because to them, it's all indoctrinated. It's like rote thinking, right? It's like they went to school and they learned that 1 + 1 = 2, but they didn't understand what plus means. To them, it's just 1 + 1 = 2. Can't be anything else. But they don't understand mathematics. They don't have the basis, the foundations to make an argument. And that's the issue with the left. The right doesn't really have this problem. That's why you notice that people on the right, whether it's on the center or even the far right, they're very willing to have these conversations. You know, a guy from Daily Stormer might be willing to speak to a libertarian and have a clash of ideas. And, you know, you might completely despise the guy's politics, but at least you are able to engage with this guy on a reasonable level, and maybe even convince him. Maybe he might, you know, shatter some of your own preconceptions, and that will help you to make better arguments next time. I don't think that's allowed on the left. I think the only guy doing it is Bill Maher, and the left hates him. And so when I saw, and this is a mild tangent here, when I saw people going after Bill Maher because he had made some, you know, bad jokes about, I think, George Bush or Donald Trump calling him an ape or something, people are trying to shut him down. I was like, well, you're going after the wrong guy. I mean, this is a guy who actually champions free speech, so maybe don't attack him. So I think that in order to win this war, we have to enable free speech. We have to keep campaigning for it. And, you know, don't pick, like, the worst examples, because the best way to alienate the left is to pick like the worst example, say Richard Spencer, and say, oh, he should be allowed to speak. He should be allowed to say these things. I think we can pick milder examples and basically sort of wean them into it, because the people being censored aren't just Richard Spencer. As you notice, he still has a Twitter account, right? People can always say, oh, he's got a Twitter account. He's not being censored. He just lost his blue check mark. What about the people who are not extreme? They're the ones being censored too. You know, Sargon of Akkad. He's a classical liberal. He gets attacked by Antifa. They try to assault him while he's speaking to an objectivist, another centrist. So that's insane to me. That these are the examples people should be pointing to, and saying, if he's not allowed to speak, then when are they going to come from me? You know, because his views aren't even extreme at all. He's left wing in many things. That's what we need to take.
How do you answer the objection that by debating by debating these people that have extremes, especially, and this is what the left would say. The left would say, if you're willing to debate somebody who's extreme right, you're legitimizing them. You're legitimizing their opinion.
I would say that's incorrect. I mean, we've had, you know, public debates about nature philosophy, about science. Like, scientists have debates all the time. We're not legitimizing anything by addressing these issues. Like, I mean, obviously, maybe you shouldn't have a debate about flat earth because it's pretty easy to disprove. But when it's, you know, an issue of politics or philosophy, it's much harder to disprove. You can't just outright say that this idea is wrong, it's false, and therefore no one should listen to it. You have to explain why it's false, because many people might believe in these ideas when we're opposing, say, Trump's policies. The media does actually a pretty good job at opposing it, and that's one of the things it does pretty well. It addresses these ideas because they're out there. And what the media fails to do is it fails to recognize that many of the ideas that they try to shut down are also out there. They're as out there as Trump is, but they refuse to address it. So all that does is grow and grow and grow and grow. And some of these ideas are very extreme, but because no one wants to address them, everyone just takes them for granted. So that's an issue. So like with anything else, I think they need to be brought into public. But I will make exceptions. You know, there are certain things I don't think need to be argued about, like, say, whether pedophilia is okay. It's already established that it's not okay. And any attempts to legitimize it, even through a discussion, I think gives ground to them because they've already lost. Pedophiles have bad PR because they're monsters, right?
Well, I wanted to go back a little bit. This is going back to the conversation we were having earlier. I wanted to mention Trump and SJWs. Trump was pro gay marriage in like 1985.
Yeah.
Trump
Long time
has,
ago.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you know, Trump is a New York liberal.
Yeah,
I grew up.
He's more liberal than Hillary Clinton.
Oh,
way more.
Especially when it comes to foreign policy things like that. Yeah, I grew up in New York City, so I've been following Trump for forever.
Yeah.
What is it about him? Do you think? What's your opinion? That just makes these people lose their fucking minds.
It's his personality. It's his ability to speak his mind in a way that they wish they could. You notice that when the left tries to meme, when the left tries to make jokes, it can only do so when it's pretending, in quote, to be awful, right? Cards Against Humanity is a vile game. It's hilarious. I love playing it, but you notice it's made by leftists, far leftists, in fact. These guys are, you know, Antifa types. And yet, when they pretend to be awful, they can be funny as hell. But when, you know, obviously, and when they're in their day-to-day interactions, they are all pretending to be nice people. They can't be funny. So when they see someone like Trump speaking his mind, and they can be as offended as they want about it because he's saying things that they wish they could say, you notice that it doesn't faze him. Their PR, their messaging, none of it affects him. He just lives off of it. He thrives because of their attacks on him. That's how, you know, he's perhaps one of the best marketers in the world, if not the best. It's the art of the deal, right? And they don't seem to realize this. They keep feeding him and they keep asking, why aren't any of our attacks working? Why is it that screaming aimlessly at the sky? Why doesn't that work? Why isn't he listening to me? It's sad because it's sad to watch them, because before their tactics would work. It would work, and it still works on a lot of people. That's how they silence you. That's how they get you fired from jobs. That's how they control the narrative, by complaining, by pretending to be victims. But here's a man that they cannot impact. And this man has a huge base, a base that cares about as much as he does about their complaints. It just laughs at them. So that's what offends them.
Yeah, I was watching an interview with Scott Adams the other day. You know who Scott Adams is, right?
Yeah, I know Scott Adams. Yeah, yeah. Dilbert.
And he was talking about, yeah, he's been trying to dissect the psychology of Trump. You know, what what Trump is doing, how he believes that Trump, when he says something, even if it sounds ridiculous, he's actually doing it for a reason so that he can, you know, he's playing a game over here so that it'll fit into the game that he's playing over here. And yeah, he said that when he gets, you know, cause he spends, now he spends a lot of time on Twitter and he talks a lot about, Trump policies. And he clearly said, I'll start talking about a Trump policy and someone will jump in and they'll start criticizing that policy. But the thing is, what they're criticizing, what they're doing, what they're saying has absolutely nothing to do with the policy. It's something completely different. So he'll be like, well, he didn't say that. That's not what he's implying that he wants to do. So do you need help understanding what that is? So he'll ask questions like that. And then the person will say, but why does it matter? Because he's Hitler. And he's like, and he's like, you can't, I mean, you literally,
can't get through them.
They're frothing at the mouth. They're like, they're rabid. They're like wild animals. It's like, I mean, how do you, as an anarchist, I'm not one of these people who believes that we all need to come together.
Mm-hmm.
I don't need, and I was on Dave Smith's podcast and I asked him, I said, do you honestly believe that you could sit down with one of these purple-headed monster triggly puffs and ever come to a consensus on how the society you want to live in together would operate? And he said, absolutely not. There's no way. So why are we trying to do this? You know, what's the point of it, right? I mean, it's almost like...
I would say the point of it is, it's performative. That's why. Like, I'm sure Scott Adams knows, and I certainly know, that when I argue with one of these purple-headed triggly puffs, I know I'm never going to get through to them. They have preconceptions about me. They believe certain things about me that are not true. They believe certain things about Trump that are not true, about video gamers, anything, right? Any subject. You name a subject, they will contradict you.
White men.
White men, yeah. Straight people. Wow. I know I'll never get through to them, but I know that people are watching. And those are the people I know who are sitting on the fence, who want to be convinced either way. They can go either way. These are the people I'm speaking to, really. So the whole thing is performative.
The lurker. You do it for the lurker.
Yeah, I do it for the lurker. I do it for the audience. Yeah. It's why entertainers make jokes. I mean, they're reaching a certain audience, right?
Yeah. So where do you, I know you write for Daily Caller. Have you been writing anything lately?
Not lately. Lately I've been kind of lax, but I'm thinking about moving into video because a lot of my audience wants me to produce videos. You know, even if they're like 10-minute videos, I think they'll watch. So I should start experimenting with it. I just haven't had the, haven't ground up the necessary courage, I suppose, to do it, even though there's nothing really stopping me, which is kind of weird.
Yeah, the, Dave Smith's actually gone to doing 10-minute videos every, releasing them at 3 o'clock. He does a 10-minute live stream at 3 o'clock every day. And he just concentrates on one subject and makes it work. So, maybe that's something.
Good idea.
Yeah, check it. Check those out. You might get some ideas from it.
Yeah, I think I will. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't have to be like 30 minutes long like Scott Adams' Periscopes. The guy's detailed. He's intensely detailed. But 10 minutes, yeah. It seems reasonable.
Yeah, 30 minutes a day. Jeez, man.
He has a lot to talk about. He's got a whiteboard and he explains his ideas. I mean, that's why I really admire him. He's really in depth. That's why his comics are so, you know, they resonate with everybody, right? Dilbert, whether you like his politics or not, you can relate to them.
You know, it's funny. He said in an interview the other day that, the smartest thing he ever did in his career was to listen to his audience, because apparently he was drawing Dilbert for a couple years, and people started writing him and saying, "We want to see Dilbert in the office more," he was taken in the beginning. He took Dilbert, you saw Dilbert at home. You saw Dilbert on the way to work and everything. And he said the greatest thing he ever did was listen to his audience. And he said, for most people who consider themselves to be artists, they don't, they would take that as a, they would take that as an insult and be like, it's my art. I do what I want and everything. And he's like, hell with it. I'll put him in the office. He said, and then as soon as he did that, it became a runaway. Yeah, it became a runaway smash. So, you have to know your audience. You don't have to give everyone in the audience everything they want. But, and that's one of my problems with Patreon. I want to ask you about this.
Yeah.
All right. You got Patreon has become something huge where, content creators can have people donate money to them on a monthly basis. And someone like, then you have stuff like Jordan Peterson who gets something like $70,000, $80,000 a month.
Yeah. Chapo Trap House gets, I think, $100,000. They're number one.
Yeah. It's crazy. Do you think if you were at that point, I mean, if you're just being handed $500,000 a year from the people who watch you.
Yeah.
Do you think that there's a chance that you would feel inclined to point your content, make your content more about what they want? And would you be scared to even change why you started doing this in the first place? Your founding principles for even, talking to the public?
I think it would depend on why you started it in the first place. Right? A lot of people start by pandering and they continue to pander forever. And then they might have a change of heart and decide, oh, I'm going to do what I want. That doesn't really work because they've been pandering for so long. But if you started your project because you made what you wanted to make and you were happy getting paid for it, I don't think it's that difficult to shift the direction of your content. If you look at PewDiePie, right, most popular YouTuber, he used to do video game streams where he would basically play a horror game and yell or pretend to be scared or maybe even be genuinely scared at the games he was playing. But he started to shift more towards commentary, not necessarily political commentary, but social media commentary, memes, things like that. And because that was what he liked. He, no longer plays as many video games as he once did. I mean, the guy's a lot older now. So I think the audience grows with you. So it's not really an issue of, wondering whether, changing your content is going to piss anyone off. I think it's only going to do that if you're not genuine in the first place. Like, PewDiePie was obviously genuine in the content that he used to make. He did some experimentation with stuff that he was not really genuine about. He did a short-lived YouTube series paid by YouTube. It didn't really go so well. It wasn't that entertaining, and you could tell that it wasn't him being himself. And then he started doing the meme content, and that was like, his real passion. So it the audience grew with him. So the change was seamless, really.
Oh, cool. Is there anything you want to mention?
I would say that, people who follow, each other on social media, if you follow me, definitely check out some of the people I retweet. Definitely, broaden your horizons. Don't just, read my tweets or read the tweets that I retweet. Also check out what the other people are saying, the people whom you normally disagree with. Maybe just follow them and see what they're saying. Maybe they'll have a point or two. Or, for the most part, it's not a lose-lose situation, because even if you get annoyed at what they're saying, you can always send them over to someone like me and I'll make fun of them. And that's comedy. These people do provide a lot of comedy with their histrionics. So social media is fun. Treat it like a game. Don't treat it like life, right? It's not real. It's a simulation.
Do you have any ethical qualms about retweeting people who have a large amount of followers, retweeting people who might be acting you know, might be being stupid to what they call retweeting to unleash the hounds on somebody.
No, I have no qualms about anything. If you're on, if you're in the public and you say something that's public, I mean, it's out there. I don't control my audience. I don't harass people personally, but I can't control what people do. And I think that if you're going to put an idea out there and it's reprehensible, then it should be addressed by the public. I mean, if you post a video of a dog, of you punching a dog, then, well, you should be vilified. It doesn't matter if you have like 10 followers. I mean, what you did was horrible. And while I don't think that spouting a bad idea is necessarily equivalent to punching a dog or cat or anything like that, I do think that, you know, opinions, if you put them out there, then expect them to be addressed. It's public, you know. If you're wearing no clothes out in public, don't be shocked when people point at you and call the police.
Do you know how many times I've seen people who've decided that they want to be famous on Twitter and they post, they make a post that's just absolutely outrageous, and then you go back to, you go to their account 6 hours later and it's locked, they've locked it on their own?
Yes. Yes, all of the time.
They can't handle the heat, man. They think they want all this attention, and they think they want to be Twitter famous. And then you go and you look and the thing's just shut down.
Yeah. They will mention me by name because I usually quote tweet them. They'll be like, oh no, Ian saw it. time to install a blockchain and block everyone he follows or everyone who follows them. And they end up blocking half of Twitter. It becomes useless.
Oh yeah, I got blocked in the Sophie Hagen. I'm gonna block the 500,000 Nazis on Twitter.
I was blocked there too. That was fun.
And I'm going, okay, let me see. I shit on Nazis all day. I shit on communists all day. I shit on authoritarians all day. Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I guess I'm a Nazi.
Have you noticed that no one talks about her anymore?
No.
Yeah. She's gone. She killed her own PR. If you're willing to put yourself out there for PR and you want to boost your reputation, then you cannot block people. Maybe you can block like a handful of people who are, you know, maybe having dumb arguments in your comments and maybe attacking you every time you say something. They're annoying to look at, right? Yeah. Good reason to block people. But if you're like Sophie Hagen and you're comedian, you know, you depend on your PR and you're blocking everyone, and if no one's talking about you, you're doing a bad job marketing yourself.
Yeah.
And you, like I said, you know, no one talks about her anymore. And why? Because she shot herself in the foot by blocking everyone. She's not relevant anymore.
I just thought it was really interesting. I mean, I had no idea that there were 500,000 Nazis in the whole world. I didn't realize that they were 500,000 on Twitter.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Apparently Twitter is full of Nazis. Like 50% of it's just Nazis.
Jesus Christ, man.
Well, these people...
Well, go ahead.
You know that meme, the political compass, where it's like right? There's four quadrants, right? Yeah. To them, they are like... They're the far left, and they're like, you know, top left, first two corners, the first two slots, and everyone else is a Nazi. That's how they view the world.
Yeah. They have an anarcho-capitalist one, too, where the anarcho-capitalists are all the way down in the right-hand corner, and the whole rest of it is communists.
That's me sometimes.
Yeah, but the best one in the past couple of days had Trump, the picture of Trump shaking hands with Kim Jong-un, and Kim Jong-un's on the top left, Trump's on the top right. Down in the bottom left is autistic screeching, the autistic screeching, liberals autistic screeching meme, and down in the bottom right is the meme is the logo for the meme generator. So it's like
we're enjoying ourselves.
We're just having the time of our lives making memes about this whole thing. So I just wish it's great not. It's great that I've reached a point in my life where I don't take politics so seriously, and it's just you can have so much more fun with it if you're not taking it so seriously, because it's really funny, and it's high entertainment.
It's high entertainment, but only if you don't take it seriously. I mean, when people, some of my fans, you know, some of my followers, they will show me some political thing, and they're upset about it. I'm like, don't be upset. Just have fun with it. You know, if you're upset like this, you're going to get a heart attack. And I used to be upset about these things. I would see one of these SJW tweets and be like, oh, this guy's crazy. I can't believe they exist. Now it's like, what a crazy person. I'm going to laugh at him.
Yeah, I like to if it's a far right or a far left tweet, I just love to retweet it and, you know, just be like, you know, you really need to up your meds or something like that. Cause I mean, it's just like, come on, you're just this is way too serious. Really, how much, since Trump has been elected, how much has your life changed? What's
probably not at all. Yeah, maybe got $1,000 bonus in some places.
Yeah. Because
the tax cut actually, not taking your money, not giving you money, but not taking so much of your money. That's a thing that people forget. They're like, oh, he gave his money. No, he didn't give you anything. It was your money to begin with. The mindset has to be changed. People need to realize that taxation is theft.
I love to hear you. I mean, we're going to have you full land cap one of these days, brother.
Yeah, I'm just a minarchist for now, but you know.
Yeah. But, you're
gearing towards it.
Man, it was great talking to you, and I want to do this again because talking to you is so easy, and you're just your attitude about all of this is great. But you know, I think you do realize that as far when it comes to free speech and all this, we do, you know, there is a fight going on.
There is a fight going on. That's the stuff I really care about because that's stuff that matters.
Yeah. So, I'm going to sign off right now. Hang out. I want to talk to you a second when we sign off. So,
sure.
Ian Miles Chung, everybody, check him out. When you write anything for the Daily Caller, let me know so that I can retweet it and share it. All right.
All right. Absolutely.
All right. Thanks a lot, brother.
Anytime.
I want to thank you for tuning in to the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. I want to thank Ian for coming on. I want to remind you about my books. They're available on my website, freemanbeyondthewall.com/store. They're only available for cryptocurrency there. If you want to use fiat, they are available on Amazon. Just search Mance Rader. I'll be back at you in the middle of the week with another podcast. So till then, take care, have a great week, and bye.